You know, I may be a little person, but I'm a big picture guy. And the big picture here is Hunter is taking it for the team. This is his punishment, his amends for his misdeeds. The goal is to keep the heat off Joe, the influence peddling, the kickbacks to the big guy. It's a small sacrifice for Hunter to make to take the fall, which is what you do in crime families where the misdeeds are far bigger and more lucrative. So what he's doing is he's deflecting it onto him.
Well, there's some accusations from Greg Gutfeld, and I assume that was yesterday before the verdict came down today quite rapidly. Hunter Biden guilty on the three charges that he was facing in that Delaware court. So we do what we always try to do here to get an expert on to talk about these things. And our friend Will Scharf is back to speak with us. He is a former federal prosecutor for the Eastern District of Missouri. He is a candidate for Missouri Attorney General. He's also working with the Trump team. Will, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you.
Great to be with you, Annie. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you being here. And I've got several questions here, or comments, I might add, from the chat as we've been going through the day. And I know that you can handle it, so I'm going to pepper you with some of these. But Hunter Biden found guilty on these charges. Is this lawfare?
No, it's not lawfare at all. What was sort of reverse lawfare was what they tried to do last year, where they gave Hunter Biden this total sweetheart plea deal where he was going to plead guilty or take a pretrial diversion on these gun charges. And in return, he was going to get total immunity for everything relating to his foreign influence peddling operation, Burisma and Bohai, Ukraine, China. I mean, millions and millions of dollars. That's the corruption of the Biden DOJ. And that was the deal that Hunter was willing to take. He was going to plead guilty to a couple minor tax charges, accept responsibility for these gun charges. And in return, he was going to get to walk. Fortunately, Judge Nareka, this judge in Delaware, blew that deal up, and it essentially painted Hunter into a corner where he couldn't accept a plea agreement because it would have imperiled him in the future and imperiled his family. So we ended up with this trial. But I mean, slapping Hunter on the wrist for these gun charges, I mean, he obviously committed these crimes. He obviously should have been convicted, but it's hiding the ball. I mean, the real story to me is still the fact that the Biden family monetized the office of the vice president, monetized Joe Biden's position to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, all coming in from foreign countries, from foreign actors. I mean, this is the greatest political corruption scandal in American history. And I hope the American people aren't distracted by this conviction. The conviction's a good thing, but it's the start of the story, not the end of the story.
So I want to drill down a little bit on what you were highlighting there, the suggestion that lawfare might be play a part in this. It's not just this week-long trial that ends in an obvious guilty verdict for Hunter Biden. It would have been quite something for there to be an exoneration in this situation. And there wasn't. He was found guilty. Compliments to the judge from you and many other legal experts that I've heard talking about it. But can you kind of drill down for me what the plea deal, where did the plea deal come from? Who gave Hunter Biden that initial sweetheart deal? And was it the Biden Justice Department that said, here's how you're going to get my son off the hook? And then was it the same people who said, I guess I just don't know that we can do that? Or did somebody pull the rug out from underneath a lawfare plan?
No. So basically what happened here, David Weiss, who's now the special counsel, was previously just acting as U.S. attorney under full supervision of the Department of Justice, of Merrick Garland, of the Biden DOJ. While he was under that supervision, he offered this insane plea agreement, which in return for two misdemeanor pleas on tax charges and a pretrial diversion agreement on these gun charges, Hunter was going to get absolute immunity from prosecution for everything else. That deal blew up. Weiss was then appointed special counsel, which is a different status, gives him much broader authority. And it was only then that we saw these charges brought with at least some degree of aggressiveness, both here in Delaware on the gun charges and in California on these tax charges, where Hunter's now also facing federal felony prosecution. But it was that break when Weiss was removed from the supervision of DOJ that we saw even an inkling of a real prosecution here.
So, you know, speaking to Weiss specifically, what would it have been like to be him in this scenario where you were talking about the different positions that he was in? I mean, what's it like to be a prosecutor in that situation?
Well, I've obviously never been a special counsel. I mean, this gun case is a very straightforward, simple case. Hunter admitted that he was crack addicted at the time he bought this gun. He admitted that in his autobiography. He then recorded that autobiography in his own voice as an audiobook, where, again, he speaks at long length about how during the time period in question, he was smoking crack every 15 minutes. So the truth of these allegations was never in question. And I'm glad this conviction resulted. But again, I mean, Weiss has broad authority to continue to prosecute Hunter and you know, potentially the rest of the Biden family as well. And the proof will be in the pudding. Does it end with this gun charge, maybe with these tax charges as well? Or does Weiss push further and really get in under the hood of the entire Biden family corruption scheme?
That's an interesting question. You brought up the autobiography. There's a lot of evidence that's just floating out there in, as you mentioned, the audio version of his book in his own voice, his own words in his own voice. But I think another very interesting portion of this particular trial has been the laptop and the testimony and the evidence that has surrounded that. What is your view on the impact of the laptop as part of this particular trial or any other ripple effect it might have elsewhere?
Yeah, look, in 2020, when the laptop first came out, the New York Post was the first publication to publish on it. There was this mad rush to discredit it. Joe Biden denied that it was a real thing. You had all of these top intelligence officials, Clapper and all of them, saying that it was clearly Russian disinformation. Now we have Biden's own Department of Justice using it as evidence in federal court, which just goes to show the lengths that the media, that the deep state were willing to go to cover up for Joe Biden in the lead up to the 2020 election. Molly Hemingway, in her book Rigged, writes extensively about this insane cover-up scheme, when I think everybody knew from the start that the laptop was real, that its contents were damning. And probably most importantly, that its contents directly implicate not just Hunter, but Joe Biden as well.
I think that's the key point here. And it's shockingly not shocking that in this trial, the laptop was used as evidence and that we had these, was it 51 high profile people who we should be able to, in theory, trust when they suggest this is Russian disinformation. That's why they put their names together on a piece of paper, because they thought that would carry some weight. It's, I guess, just kind of accepted now that the laptop is real. And if this were a new revelation in this trial, I think that it would have made a bigger splash in the news. But I think that it's so widely understood and accepted that my question is, did those individuals who signed that paper really believe it was Russian disinformation? Or was their intent specifically to deceive, to benefit a political candidate for president?
I think the only thing they cared about was Joe Biden winning the election. And they knew that if the laptop were widely reported on in the lead up to the 2020 election, Joe would have lost. The polling bears that out pretty conclusively. So they did what Democrats always do. They lined up like lemmings to support their preferred political candidate, the truth be damned. And that should outrage Americans of all political stripes. Mm-hmm. When we have government agencies, government officials that we just simply can't trust anymore, that view themselves as political actors as opposed to civil servants, that's a very damning indictment of where we are as a country right now. I would encourage all of your listeners, Marco Polo, group run by Garrett Ziegler, who's a friend of mine, has published the contents of the laptop in a very readable form. If you want to know more about what Hunter and Joe and Jim Biden were actually doing, you've got to read the contents of this laptop. In addition to all the drug use and the prostitutes and all the other Hunter stuff, the actual financial transactions are fascinating, and every American should know about them because it has to inform your opinion of who Joe Biden is as a person. He is venal. He is corrupt. He has been his whole career. When he was vice president, they speedily went around his family members and monetized that office, cutting deals with China, cutting deals in Ukraine, cutting deals all over the world, stashing money in offshore bank accounts. I mean, the details are just absolutely damning. And the fact that Biden has defended Hunter for as long as he has, to me, speaks to the fact that Joe is not just sympathetic to his son as a father, but is deeply worried that if Hunter were to ever turn on him, the House of Cards would come collapsing down.
And when you referred earlier to this guilty verdict and everything to be hiding the ball, is this the ball that we're talking about?
I think the ball is the Biden family's foreign influence peddling operation, which I've said before, I think is the greatest political scandal in American history. I mean, when the founders talked about the dangers of a strong central government, one of their deepest fears was that people at senior levels of the new federal government would sell out to foreign powers. And that's exactly what we saw from Joe Biden, particularly with respect to China, where Hunter and Jim were getting millions, tens of millions of dollars from CEFC, from Chinese Communist Party officials through this sort of shell private equity fund. They never did any work for that money. There were never any deals. It was just a straight payoff. Joe Biden was compromised by the Chinese government, was bribed, I believe, by the Chinese Communist government through Hunter Biden. I think the contents of Hunter's laptop lay that out very clearly. You know, Joe used to say back in 2020, he said, "I never talked about business with my son." Then the story shifted to, "I've never been in business with my son." The story keeps shifting. The real story is that Joe knew exactly what was going on. He knew what Hunter was up to. And what Hunter was up to was selling Joe Biden's influence to foreign powers, which is just, again, it's the greatest political corruption scandal in American history.
Will Scharf speaking with us right now. Before we get to a break, on the other side of this break, Will's going to stick with us and we're going to shift a little bit into Trump legal challenges that he's facing. This guilty verdict today, we know on September 5th, they're supposed to begin trial on the tax charges that he is facing for not paying his taxes. Maybe that changes a bit, too, for Hunter Biden, how he chooses to approach that case. But we've got the laptop. It's evidence as identified by the government. You've got the guilty verdicts. You're talking about the ball that they're hiding right now, which is the greatest American scandal in American history. Are we any closer as a country to getting to the bottom of all of these things that you're alleging? Will the American people find out?
I think if this tax case goes to trial, Hunter's not close to being held accountable. I mean, being prosecuted for, you know, misstating his taxes, failing to pay taxes, barely scratches the surface. But the underlying details in that case do start approaching what we're talking about here. The fact that he was getting millions of dollars in from offshore entities, that he failed to disclose that. There's a lot that could come out in that case that I think would begin to inform the American public. But again, the mainstream media is unwilling to report on any of this. They still, in some sense, have internalized the idea that the information in the laptop, that the information from whistleblowers is somehow politically concocted, when in actuality, it's just the truth. This is stuff that everybody knew. Joe Biden clearly knew what his son was doing. And the details in texts, in emails on that laptop prove what the scheme was, prove that this was, in fact, an influence peddling operation. And the one fact that I think really came through from this gun trial, which directly bears on this entire conversation, is that Hunter was not compos mentis. Hunter was not, you know, a high functioning crack addict. He was an incredibly poor functioning crack addict. The idea that he was providing meaningful business services to any of these foreign partners during the time period in question, when he was, according to his own admission, smoking crack on an hourly basis every single day, going on these long benders, disappearing. I mean, it just goes to show that these folks knew exactly what they were paying him for. And what they were paying him for was influence and influence with and access to Joe Biden.
Finally, on the Hunter question, you're saying that a lot of these details could be revealed in that trial for the tax charges. That leads me to believe there's no way that this goes to trial in September.
I think they may try to delay that trial until after the election. They may also try to structure some sort of plea agreement to keep a lot of those details from coming to public light. I believe that the day after the November election, Joe Biden will pardon Hunter and pardon his brother Jim to ensure that they're not in the sort of legal jeopardy that could lead them to flipping on him. Mm-hmm. I think Jim Biden in particular, Joe Biden's brother, is an underreported actor in all of these cases. He's been involved with a mafia-connected healthcare scam. I mean, that guy has a lot of dirt on him and has carried a lot of water for Joe Biden over the years. Hunter as well is obviously in the same boat. So one way or the other, I expect that, you know, the Bidens will end up sticking together here and that Joe will end up doing what he needs to do to prevent his own criminality from coming to light.
Will it involve a pardon for himself?
Self-pardon is an issue that the Supreme Court has never dealt with. They've never ruled on the constitutionality of a president pardoning himself. But Joe could certainly try. I think if he thinks he's facing real legal jeopardy on leaving office, that's definitely something that I think he would try. And he would couch it in terms of he and his family are being unfairly oppressed and all that. It's absolute garbage. Joe Biden is where he is now because of decisions that he made and because of decisions that his family made. He profited to the tune of millions of dollars over the years from these deals that Hunter was entering into. And I believe he should be held accountable.
Well, speaking of presidential self-pardons, let's hold on for just a minute and talk to Will Scharf on the other end of this break about Donald Trump, because this November election is upon us and there's a ton at stake. And we're going to ask him about the legal challenges that President Donald Trump faces as well. Will, hold on just a minute. We'll be right back with you. You've been listening to Will Scharf, who is a former federal prosecutor for the Eastern District of Missouri. He is a Trump attorney and he is also candidate for Missouri Attorney General. Will Scharf with us on Trump when we come back. Don't go away.
We have responsibility, Carrie. We did not have any accountability for what was going on there, and we should have. This is ridiculous. You're going to ask me in the middle of the thing when they've already breached the inaugural stuff that should we call the Capitol Police? I mean, the National Guard? Why weren't the National Guard there to begin with?
They thought that they had sufficient resources.
No, there's not a question of how they had, but they don't know. They clearly didn't know, and I take responsibility for not having them just prepare for more.
So Nancy Pelosi, from inside a car on January 6th, you hear her say there, she's going, "What's going on? Where's the National Guard?" And then she says, "I take responsibility." Well, I want to start our next segment here with Will Scharf off with that sound, because there's a lot of sensationalism that's being injected into this tape. But it is pretty wild to hear Nancy Pelosi asking these questions, knowing that Donald Trump did make available the National Guard. Will Scharf, welcome back on with us. Does this clip of Nancy Pelosi mean anything to you in your relationship with Donald Trump and the court cases that he's under regarding January 6th?
Yeah, the left has peddled this narrative. They've peddled this narrative since January 6th that President Trump did January 6th, that he's responsible solely. They set up this fake committee, the January 6th committee, to push out this heavily produced account of what happened. And it's just totally false. The fact of the matter is that President Trump offered to have 10,000 National Guardsmen on hand. He offered to help secure the Capitol. His offers were rebuffed.
Who did he offer those to?
What's
the process there? Because people dispute that. If you're saying Trump offered all of those National Guardsmen, who did he make that offer to and who said no?
It would have been the folks in charge of Capitol security, ultimately ending in terms of their chain of command with Speaker Pelosi. So this is the false narrative. You know, I was in the Capitol the day that Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And there were thousands and thousands and thousands of fired up protesters outside. There were some protesters in the gallery who were arrested and taken away. That building was surrounded by a ring of steel that day. There was no conceivable way anybody from that crowd outside was getting inside without proper credentials, was making it past the security lines. It was a ring of steel. You look at the pictures from January 6th, and it's a couple Capitol policemen with bike racks. This is not how the Capitol is usually secured when there's evidence that there may be a major disturbance. And I think those are the questions that the American people deserve answers to. But instead, what we've gotten is this absolute cover-up. A cover-up on anything approaching accountability for the lack of security at the Capitol that day. And again, President Trump made bona fide offers to have National Guardsmen, to have additional federal law enforcement, to have the security they needed around that building that day, and he was rebuffed. And I think you have to ask the question of why. But I think certainly this tape of Nancy Pelosi admitting on the day of that there was more that she could have and should have done to secure the Capitol that day, it definitely challenges the mainstream leftist narrative of what happened on January 6th and who is ultimately responsible and accountable.
You know, it seems from where I sit, which is just an observational place, I don't have any expertise in this, but I pay a lot of attention to it. And the idea that Donald Trump incited an insurrection is pivotal and central to what the Democrats have made this entire election about. And the idea that Donald Trump would be ineligible to be a candidate for office once again, it seemed that it was most important to make him unelectable again in any ways that they or any means necessary. Knowing what we hear here from Nancy Pelosi and understanding how Capitol Hill works and everything, what do you wish the American people really understood that maybe they've been misinformed or disinformed about that day on January 6th?
I would encourage every American, and particularly your listeners, to go back and listen to the entirety of President Trump's speech on the Ellipse at on January 6th. Don't listen to selective cuts or edits. His speech was a great speech, and he talked a lot about election fraud. He talked a lot about the policy challenges facing America in the future. And then he called on people to peacefully and patriotically protest, and nothing more. If you listen to the speech in its entirety, President Trump did absolutely nothing wrong. Instead, what we've gotten for years is selectively edited clips of that speech that make it seem like President Trump was doing something or calling for something that he just wasn't. And they've attempted to shift culpability for what any number of people did or didn't do onto President Trump's shoulders solely. And that's just wrong. That's why we had this insane effort to disqualify him from the ballot. That's a large part of, I believe, why we're dealing with this prosecution in Washington, D.C. It's this false leftist narrative that's taken hold over what President Trump did on January 6th, when in actuality, the speech he gave was, there was nothing wrong with it. It was totally conventional political rhetoric, heated perhaps, but he did nothing more than to call for people to peacefully and patriotically protest, as is their God-given right protected by the U.S. Constitution. So again, with respect to January 6th, I firmly believe that President Trump did nothing wrong. And I think that as more facts come to light in the coming years, that picture is going to become clearer and clearer.
We're speaking with Will Scharf. He is a former federal prosecutor of the Eastern District of Missouri, a Trump attorney, and also candidate for Missouri Attorney General. I want to stay here on the January 6th case before we get to the Alvin Bragg Manhattan case. I want to ask you about some of the appeal situation involved in that one in a minute. But I think I recall, I don't know if it was you or another legal expert I had on there saying that maybe the January 6th one could possibly see some light of day before the election takes place. And I know we're waiting on Supreme Court rulings. Where's the status right now for the pending trials outside of the one where he has now been found guilty on 34 counts? What is the status of those other trials leading up to the election?
So I'll deal with the two easy ones first. Georgia is going nowhere quickly because the Georgia Courts of Appeals are now considering our move to have Fani Willis disqualified off of that case. So that trial is not scheduled. It's unlikely to move anytime soon. We likely won't have an opinion on the disqualification issue itself until perhaps late this year or early next year. If Fani Willis is disqualified, I think that case is on life support. I definitely don't think it's going to trial. Florida is in a similar boat, that Judge Cannon in Florida is investigating issues, very serious issues of prosecutorial misconduct relating to witness intimidation, evidentiary custody issues. In the meantime, she's vacated the trial date there, has not rescheduled it. There are numerous issues that need to be resolved before that case gets close to trial, if it even makes it to trial at all. So again, it's not going to be electorally relevant. Lastly, we have D.C. D.C. is absolutely stayed. All proceedings are stayed pending resolution by the U.S. Supreme Court of our presidential immunity appeal, which we could see a judgment on as early as this week. this Thursday or Friday or two opinion days for the court. Assuming we win anything there, and I think that we will, the chances of that case making it to trial before the election are essentially zero. Even if we were to have an absolute loss, the earliest they could bring the case to trial would be right at the end of October. And I don't think even Judge Chutkan in D.C. will do that. Mm. So in terms of the campaign of lawfare against President Trump, this scheme to force him through criminal trial after criminal trial after criminal trial at the height of the election season, we've largely won, with the exception of New York. And the New York trial, it was absolutely insane. The legal theory was, you know, full of holes. Their unconstitutionality suffuses that case. We look forward to getting it up on appeal, where I believe that we will win. In the meantime, though, it's deeply shameful, I believe, that President Trump was forced to sit through that sham of a trial instead of being allowed to go out and campaign for office, as is his First Amendment right.
I want to read a couple comments here from listeners, and it's on the appeal process of that trial. Vicky said, Annie, can you ask Will the grounds Trump has to appeal? And she's trying to kind of help out Edward, who was talking about the appeals. And Edward replied, Will's a lawyer. He's just going to give a vague answer like, quote, what grounds won't we appeal? So you can choose Edward's quote there, or maybe be more specific on what grounds that Donald Trump has to appeal and potentially win on appeal in that Alvin Bragg Manhattan case.
So, I mean, I'm not trying to be vague. I will get specific. There are literally dozens of grounds to appeal this case. Reversible error is present in almost every decision made by the judge during this case. A couple things that I would note in particular, the jury unanimity issue, the fact that the jury did not have to be unanimous on the alleged unlawful means that underlay this sort of election conspiracy scheme, that's a major due process violation. There are evidentiary issues that we would want to appeal, particularly the exclusion of evidence from Brad Smith and Robert Costello, two defense witnesses, one of whom we ended up calling anyway, one of whom we didn't, allowing in evidence from Stormy Daniels and David Pecker and other witnesses that was just wildly prejudicial and not at all probative. The fact that we weren't on proper notice of what the actual prosecution theory was until really closing arguments is reversible. The fact that Judge Merchan didn't recuse from the case when he clearly should have, that's under the 14th Amendment, that's a due process issue under the Supreme Court's precedent in Caperton v. Massey. That's something that we would want to challenge as well. I can go on in this vein for a while longer if you want me to, Annie.
I was just going to say, Vicky and Edward, to name a few. He's doing so.
This is, I mean, this case is an appellate lawyer's dream. We will get it overturned on appeal. The problem is that the damage is already done, that President Trump has been forced to sit through this show trial for the better part of 2 months. And the Biden administration gets what they wanted all along, which is the talking point that they get to say that President Trump's a convicted felon. Even though I think the American people see through this, I think there's a reason that President Trump smashed political fundraising records in the immediate aftermath of the trial, why his poll numbers are climbing and not falling in the aftermath of the trial. I think the American people see this sham conviction for what it was. And I think they're responding by supporting President Trump even more than they did before.
Yeah, you know, Will, I just keep thinking to myself that when a defendant is found guilty, you should think to yourself, like, I'm glad that that person will not be able to do that to the people that were hurt any longer. And then I have to think that if Donald Trump were to commit the crime that they found him guilty for, I don't even think he'd know how to commit the crime again. I don't even think he'd be able to retrace the steps in order to maneuver the acrobatic nature with which they charged him with that. It's so convoluted and confusing.
Yeah, I mean, the trial, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, they're alleging that bookkeeping entries made in 2017 were intended to cover up a scheme in 2016. They're alleging it's a circular argument. They're saying one of the possible illegal means that the jury could have decided this case on is the idea that these bookkeeping entries were intended to cover up an unlawful scheme to affect the 2016 election, and the illegal means used to affect the election was these bookkeeping entries that didn't happen until after the election. So just at a basic level, there are like legal impossibility issues with the way that the prosecution ended up presenting its case. It's almost like Russian nesting dolls, you know, those weird things where you have sort of the big Russian doll and then the smaller doll and then the littler doll. And you get down to the bottom and there's just nothing.
Yeah.
And that was one of the most confusing things I know for the trial team with this case. It was like trying to, you know, pin down Jell-O at times with like, what is the prosecution's actual theory here? What are we defending against? And then there's the fact that you had Michael Cohen as sort of the star witness, the only guy who could pull it all together, who happens to be a multi convicted perjurer. He admitted to grand larceny and bank fraud on the stand. Somehow he's never been prosecuted for that. I mean, this whole prosecution, the whole trial, just reeks of politics. And I was trained that, you know, prosecutions are never supposed to be political, that politics are never supposed to enter the equation, much less dictate charging decisions and dictate the entire prosecution from the start.
Well, Shar, final question. You have spent time around and with Donald Trump throughout the, all of these trials that he's facing right now. Has this guilty verdict affected his resolve to get the job done in November?
No, he is relentless, implacable, unstoppable. I mean, the guy just has boundless energy. It's immensely impressive to me, you know, as I sort of go through campaigning and legal work, and I'm exhausted constantly. It doesn't seem to affect President Trump at all. That really, from the day after the trial, it was just on to business. It was on to, you know, getting back to the campaign trail, carrying his message to the American people. You've all seen him at rallies. I mean, what you see is what you get. This is a guy who's deeply committed to the mission that he's on. And none of this campaign of lawfare is going to derail him from that mission. So I'm deeply impressed by President Trump, by his resolve, by his commitment to doing what he needs to do. And I think that's one of the main reasons why he's going to be our next president.
Yeah, well, I've talked to a lot of people after that guilty verdict came down, and it just didn't seem to have the effect that I believe that the Democrats would have hoped that it would. And the fundraising hall, more evidence of that as well. Thanks for being with us today, Will. We always love having you here. Come back soon.
Great to be with you, Annie. Thank you.
Thank you. Will Scharf, former federal prosecutor for the Eastern District of Missouri, former policy director for Missouri Governor's Office. He's also a candidate for Missouri Attorney General and a Donald Trump attorney. And always great to have him here as a friend of the Annie Frye Show. Let's take a quick break. Joe Biden is speaking with Moms Demand Action at an Every Town for Gun Safety. You cannot make this stuff up. It's like, I keep thinking, if you were writing a movie, if you were putting together a script, you would be like, no, that would never happen. No communications department would ever allow him to be speaking at this kind of a rally when a guilty verdict for his son who just committed a gun crime would come down. It's kind of the same as like if you were having this trial with Donald Trump, you would never have, what's his name, David Pecker. You would be like, that's too on the nose. We'll move on from there. It's ridiculous. Let's hear what Joe Biden has to say at this event when we come back. Don't go away.